Chapter 10. Soon there came to our corridor a boy yelling, "Lobsang! Lobsang!" I hastened across the room and met him at the door as he was about to enter. "Phew!" he exclaimed, wiping imaginary perspiration from his brow. "I've looked everywhere for you. Been in hiding or something? Your guide wants you." "What does he look like?" I asked in some anxiety. "Look like? What do you expect him to look like? You saw him just a few days ago. What's wrong with you? Are you sick or something?" The boy wandered off, muttering about stupid. I turned away and pulled my robe straight and felt to be sure that my bowl and charm box was in place, and then I walked up the corridor. It was a pleasure to leave the boy's quarters with the smeared lime-washed walls and enter the much more ornate lama's quarters. As I wandered softly along, I could see into most of the rooms I passed. Most of the lamas kept their doors open. Here, an old man was fingering his beads and reciting endlessly, "Om Mani Padme Hum." Another was reverently turning the pages of some old, old book, looking unceasingly for yet another meaning from the scriptures. It rather bothered me to see these old men trying to read between the lines, trying to read into writing those messages which were not put there in the first place. Then they would burst out with, "A new interpretation of the scriptures by Lama so-and-so." A very ancient man with a straggly white beard was gently twirling a prayer wheel and crooning to himself as he did so. Yet another was declaiming to himself, practicing for a forthcoming theological debate in which he was to take a leading part. "Now don't you come here bringing dirt to my clean floor, you young squirt," said a testy old cleaning monk as he leaned on his brush and eyed me balefully. "I don't work here all day for the likes of you." "Go and jump out of the window, old one," I said rudely as I walked past him. He stretched out and tried to grab me, but tripping over his long brush handle, fell to the floor with a resounding thud. I hastened my steps so as to have a head start before he could climb to his feet. No one took any notice. Prayer wheels still hummed and clacked, the declaimer still declaimed, and voices still intoned their mantras. In some near room, an old man was hawking and clearing his throat with horrid noises. "Rawr, rawr, rawr," he went in his endless attempt to obtain relief. I walked on. These corridors were long, and I had to walk from the quarters of the lowest form of lamastic life to almost the highest, to that of the very senior lamas. Now, as I progressed towards the better area, more and more doors were shut. At last, I turned off the main corridor and entered a small annex, the domain of the special ones. Here, in the place of honor, my guide resided when at the Patala. With a rapidly beating heart, I stopped at a door and knocked. "Come in," said a well-loved voice. I entered and made my ritual bows to the shining personage sitting with his back to the window. The Lama, Mingyar Dondup, smiled kindly at me and very carefully looked at me to see how I had fared during the past 7 days or so. "Sit down, Lobsang, sit down," he said, pointing to a cushion placed before him. For some time we sat while he asked me questions. Most difficult to answer, some of them were, too. This great man filled me with the deepest feelings of love and devotion. I wanted nothing more than to be continually in his presence. The inmost one is very pleased with you, he remarked, adding idly, and I suppose that calls for some sort of celebration. He stretched out his hand and tinkled a small silver bell. A serving monk entered and brought a low table, one of those ornate things carved and with many coats of color. I was always afraid of scratching or marking these wretched things. The table was placed to the right of my guide. Smiling at me, the Lama turned to the serving monk and said, "You have the plain table ready for Lobsang?" "Yes, master," the man replied. "I will fetch it now." He left, soon returning with a very plain table, which had the best ornaments of all. It was laden with things from India, sweet and sticky cakes which were covered with some sort of syrup, which had then been sprinkled with sugar, pickled walnuts, special chestnuts which had been brought from a far, far country, and many other items which delighted my heart. The serving monk smiled slightly as he also put beside me a large jar of the herbs which we used when afflicted with indigestion. Another serving monk entered bearing small cups and a large jug full of steaming Indian tea. At a sign from my guide, they withdrew, and I had a pleasant change from Sampa. I did not bother to think about the other acolytes, who probably never in their lives had tasted anything except Sampa. I knew quite well that probably Sampa would be their only food for as long as they lived, and I consoled myself with the thought that if they suddenly had a taste of these exotic foods from India, it would make them dissatisfied. I knew that I was going to have a hard time in life. I knew that soon there would be very different foods for me. So in my small boy's smug complacency, I thought there was nothing wrong in having a foretaste of pleasant things to compensate for the unpleasant things which I had already endured. So I ate more than I should have with complete tranquility. My guide remained silent, and all he had was tea, the Indian variety. But eventually, with a sigh of the utmost regret, I decided that I could not take even another crumb. In fact, the mere sight of that wretched food was beginning to appear distasteful to me. It was coloring my outlook, and I felt, well, as if enemies were fighting inside me. I became aware that certain unwanted specks were floating before my eyes, so I had no more to eat, and before long I had to withdraw to another place, for the food had stretched my stomach rather painfully. When I returned, somewhat paler, considerably lighter, and a little shaken, my guide was still sitting, still unruffled, quite benign. He smiled at me as I settled myself again, saying, "Well, now you've had and lost most of your tea. You at least have the memory of it, and that might help you. We will talk about various things." I settled myself very comfortably. His eyes were roaming, no doubt wondering how my injuries were, and then he told me, "I had a talk with the inmost one, who told me of your, flying onto the golden roof. His Holiness told me all about it, told me what he had seen, and told me that you risked expulsion to tell him the truth. He's very pleased with you, very pleased with the reports he has had about you, very pleased with what he's seen, for he was watching you when you were looking for me, and now I have special orders about you. The Lama looked at me, smiled slightly, possibly amused at the expression which I knew was on my face. More trouble, I thought, more tales of woe to come, more hardships to endure now, so that they won't appear so bad in the future by comparison. I am sick of the hardship, I thought to myself. Why can't I be like some of those people who flew those kites in a battle, or drove those roaring steam boxes with a lot of soldiers? I thought, too, I would rather like to be in charge of one of those metal things which floated on water and took a lot of people between countries. Then my attention wandered and I pondered the question, how could they be metal? Anyone would know that metal was heavier than water, and so it would sink. There must be a catch to it, I decided. They could not be metal at all. That monk must have been telling me a story. I looked up to see my guide laughing at me. He'd been following my thoughts by telepathy, and he was really amused. Those kites are airplanes. The steam dragon is a train. And those iron boxes are ships. And, yes, iron ships really do float. I will tell you all about that later, but for the moment, we have other things in mind. He rang his bell again. A serving monk entered and removed the table which had been before me, smiling ruefully at all the havoc I had made of the foods from India. My guide said we wanted more tea, and we waited while a fresh lot was brought to us. "I prefer Indian tea to China tea," said my guide. I agreed with him. China tea always rather sickened me. I did not know why, because I was obviously more used to China tea, but the Indian tea seemed to be more pleasant. Our discussion on the matter of tea was interrupted by the serving monk bringing in a fresh supply. He withdrew as my guide poured fresh cups of tea. His Holiness has said that you be withdrawn from the ordinary standard classes. Instead, you are to move into an apartment next to mine, and you are to be taught by me and by the leading Lama specialists. You have the task of preserving much of the ancient knowledge, and later you will have to put much of that knowledge into writing. For our most alert seers have forecast the future of our country, saying that we shall be invaded, and much that is in this Lamasery and others will be ravaged and destroyed. Through the wisdom of the Inmost One, certain records are already being copied, so that copies will remain here to be destroyed, and the original ones will be taken far, far away, where no invader will be able to reach. First, you will have to be taught extensively about the metaphysical arts. He stopped speaking and rose to his feet and moved into another room. I heard him rustling about, and then he came back, carrying a very plain wooden box which he brought and placed on the ornamental table. He sat down before me, and for a moment or two remained silent. Years and years ago, people were very different from what they are now. Years and years ago, people could call upon the natural laws and use senses which humanity has now lost, except in certain rare instances. Many hundreds of centuries ago, people were telepathic and clairvoyant, but through using such powers for evil purposes, humans as a whole have lost the ability. The whole of those powers now are atrophied. Worse, humans now generally deny the existence of such powers. You will find when you move about to different countries that when you leave Tibet and India, it will not be wise to talk of clairvoyance, astral traveling, levitation, or telepathy, because people will merely say, "Prove it, prove it. You talk in riddles, you talk nonsense. There is no such thing as this or that or something else. If there were, science would have discovered it." He withdrew into himself for a moment, and a shadow crossed his features. He had traveled extensively, and although he looked young, well, actually he looked ageless, one could not say if he were an old lama or a young man. His flesh was firm and his face fairly unlined. He radiated health and vitality. Yet I knew that he had traveled to faraway Europe, traveled to Japan, China, and India. I knew, too, that he had seen some of the most amazing experiences. Sometimes, when he was sitting, he would look at some magazine which had been brought over the mountains from India, and then he would sigh with sorrow at the folly of warring mankind. There was one particular magazine which really interested him, and whenever he could, he had brought it from India. It was a peculiar sort of magazine called London Illustrated. I found odd copies of the magazine to be a great source of information, giving me pictures about things quite beyond my understanding. I was interested in what were called advertisements, and whenever I could, I tried to read the pictures, and then, as opportunity presented itself, I would find someone who knew enough of the strange language to tell me about the wording. I sat and looked at my guide. Occasionally, I looked at the wooden box which he had brought out and wondered what it could possibly contain. It was a box of some wood quite foreign to me. It had 8 sides to it so that, as near as anything, it was round. I sat for some time wondering what it was all about, what was in it, why he had suddenly lapsed into silence, and then he spoke. "Lobsang, you have to develop your very high degree of natural clairvoyance to an even higher state, and the first thing is to get to know this." Briefly, he motioned to the 8-sided wooden box, as if that would explain everything, but it just led me into a deeper state of confusion. "I have here a present which is given to you by order of the Inmost One himself. It is given to you to use, and with it you can do much good." He leaned forward and with 2 hands picked up the wooden box and looked at it for a few moments before putting it in my hands. He put it very carefully in my hands, and held his own hands nearby in case I, boy-like, should be clumsy and drop it. It was a surprising weight, and I thought it must have a lump of stone inside it to be so heavy. "Open it, Lobsang," said the Lama Mingyar Dandap. "You will not get any information about it by just looking at the box." Dumbly, I turned the thing in my hands, hardly knowing how to open it, because it was eight-sided, and I could not see how the top fitted on. But then I grasped the top and somehow gave it a half-twist. The top, domed portion came off in my hands. I peered at it, and it was just a lid, so I put it down beside me while I devoted my attention to what was in the box. All I could see was a lump of cloth, so I grasped that and went to lift it out, but the weight was quite amazing. I spread my robe carefully so that if there was anything loose inside, it would not fall on the floor. And then, with my hands over the box, I inverted the box and took the weight of the contents on my fingers. I put down the now empty box and devoted my attention to the spherical object wrapped up in a dead black cloth. As my busy fingers unwrapped the thing, I gasped in fascinated awe, for revealed to me now was a very wonderful, quite flawless, crystal. It was indeed crystal, not like the glass used by fortune tellers, but this crystal was so pure that one could hardly see where it began and ended. It was almost like a sphere of nothingness as I held it in my hands. That is, until I contemplated the weight. And the weight was quite formidable. It weighed as much as a stone of the same size would weigh. My guide looked at me smilingly. As I met his eyes, he said, "You have the right touch, Lobsang. You are holding it in the correct manner. Now you will have to wash it before you can use it, and you will have to wash your hands as well." "Wash it, Honorable Lama," I said in some amazement. "Whatever should I wash it for? It's perfectly clean, perfectly clear." "Yes, but it is necessary that any crystal be washed when it changes hands, because the crystal has been handled by me, and then the inmost one handled it, and I handled it again after. So now you do not want to delve into my past or my future, and it is, of course, forbidden to delve into the past, present, or future of the inmost one. Therefore, go into the other room," he motioned with his hand to the direction I should take, "and wash your hands. Then wash the crystal, and make sure that you pour water over it so that it be running water. I will wait here until you have finished." Very carefully I wrapped up the crystal and eased myself off the cushion where I had been sitting, placing the crystal on its center so that it could not fall off onto the ground. When I had regained my feet and was standing more or less securely, I reached and lifted the cloth wrap bundle and left the room. It was a beautiful thing to hold in water. As I rubbed my hands around it under the water, it seemed to glow with life. It felt as if it were a part of me. It felt as if it belonged to me, as indeed now it did. I gently set it aside and washed my own hands, making sure that I used plenty of fine sand, and then I rinsed them and went back and rewashed the crystal, holding it beneath a jug which I inverted while the water splashed over the crystal, making a little rainbow as the falling drops were struck by the incoming sunlight. With the crystal clean and my hands clean too, I returned to the room of my guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondup. You and I are going to be much closer in the future. We're going to live next door to each other, for so the Inmost One has decreed. You are not to sleep in the dormitory after this night. Arrangements are being made whereby when we return to Shakpuri tomorrow, you will have a room next to mine. You will study with me, and you will study with learned lamas who have seen much, done much, and traveled in the astral. You will also keep your crystal in your room, and no one else must touch it, because it would give a different influence to it. Now, move your cushion and sit with your back to the light. I shuffled round, and with my back to the light, I sat rather close to the window, carefully clutching the crystal in my hands, but my guide was not satisfied. No, no, be sure that no ray of light falls on the crystal, for if it does, you will make false reflections within. It is necessary that there be no points of light in the crystal. Instead, you must be aware of it, but not aware of its exact circumference. He rose to his feet and pulled an oil silk curtain over the window, subduing the sunlight and making the room flood with a pale blue glow, almost as if twilight had come upon us. It should be said that we had very little glass in Lhasa, or rather, very little glass in Tibet, because all glass had to be brought across the mountains on the backs of traders or on the backs of their pack animals, and in the sudden storms which beset our city, glass would be shattered immediately by the wind-driven stones. Thus, we had shutters made of different material. Some were of wood, and others were of oil silk or similar, which shut out the wind and shut out the dust. But the oil silk was the best because it let sunlight filter through. At last, I was in a position which my guide considered to be suitable. I was sitting with my legs tucked underneath me, not in the lotus position, because my legs had been too much damaged for that. But I was sitting with my legs tucked under me and my feet were protruding to the right. In my lap, my cupped hands held the crystal, held it beneath so that I could not see my hands under the bulging sides of that globe. My head was bowed, and I had to look at the crystal, or in the crystal, without actually seeing, without actually focusing. Instead, to see correctly in a crystal, one must focus at a point in infinity, because if one focused directly at the crystal, one focuses automatically on any smear or speck of dusk or any reflection, and that usually destroys the effect. So, I was taught to always focus at some point in infinity while apparently looking through the crystal. I was reminded of my experiences in the temple when I had seen the wandering souls come in range, and where the nine lamas had been doing their chant, punctuating each reference to a stick of incense by the tinkling of a silver bell. My guide smiled across at me and said, "Now, There is no time to do any crystal gazing or scrying for the moment, because you will be taught properly, and this is a case of more haste, less speed. You want to learn how to hold the thing properly, as indeed you are doing now, but you want to learn the different methods of holding for different occasions. If you want world affairs, you use the crystal on a stand. Or if you want to read about one individual, you take the crystal and let the inquirer hold it first, after which you take it from him, and if you're properly trained, you can see that which he wants to know. Just at that moment, pandemonium broke out above us. There was the deep, roaring, discordant sound of the conches, like yaks lowing in the meadows, a ululating sound which wobbled up and down the scale like an excessively fat monk trying to waddle along. I could never discern any music in the conches. Others could, and they told me it was because I was tone deaf. After the conches came the blare of the temple trumpets and the ringing of bells and the beating of wooden drums. My guide turned to me and said, "Well, Love Sang, you and I had better go to service, because the inmost one will be there, and it is common courtesy for us to go on our last evening here at the Potala. I must hurry off. You come at your own speed." So saying, he rose to his feet, gave me a pat on the shoulder, and hurried out. Very carefully, I wrapped up my crystal, wrapped it very, very carefully indeed, and then, with the utmost caution, I put it back in the 8-sided wooden box. I put it on the table by the seat of my guide, the Lama Mengyur Dondap, and then I, too, followed down the corridor. Acolytes, monks, and lamas were hurrying along from all directions. It reminded me of a disturbed colony of ants rushing along. People seemed to be in a hurry so that they could get in the best position relative to their own class. I was in no hurry so long as I got somewhere and could sit without being seen. That was all I asked. The sound of the conches ceased. The blaring of the trumpets ended. By now, the stream entering the temple had diminished to a trickle, and I found myself following at the tail end. This was the great temple, the temple at which attended the inmost one himself when he had time from his world duties to come and mix with the lamas. The great pillars supporting the roof seemed to soar into the blackness of night. Above us there were the ever-present clouds of incense smoke, grays and blues and whites swirling and intermingling and yet never seeming to settle out into one particular shade, for all these clouds of incense seemed in some way to retain their own individuality. Small boys were rushing around with the flaring torches, lighting more and more butter lamps, which sputtered and hissed and then burst into flames. Here and there was a lamp which had not been properly lighted, because one had first to rather melt the butter so that it became liquid like oil, otherwise the wick should be floating, merely charred and smoldered, and made us sneeze with the smoke. At last sufficient lamps were lit, and huge sticks of incense were brought out, and they too were lit, and then extinguished so that they glowed red and gave out great clouds of smoke. As I looked about me, I saw all the lamas in one group, in rows, facing each other, and the next row would be back to back, and so on, facing each other, and the next row would be back to back again. Farther out from them were the monks sitting in a similar manner, and beyond those, the acolytes. The lamas had little tables about a foot high on which reposed various small items, including the ever-present silver bell. Some had wooden drums, and later, as the service started, the lector, standing at his lectern, would read out passages from our sacred books, and the lamas and monks in unison would chant. And the lamas would, at the completion of each passage, ring their bells, while others would tap with their fingers on the drums, again and again, to signify the end of some particular part of the service. There would be the rumbling of the conches from somewhere in the distance, somewhere in the dim recesses of the temple. I looked on, but it was merely a spectacle to me. It was merely religious discipline, and I decided at some time, when I had time, I would ask my guide why it was necessary to go through this ceremony. I wondered if it made people any better, because I had seen so many monks who were very devout, very devoted indeed to their service attendances. But away from the temples, away from the services, they were sadistic bullies. Yet others, who never went near the temples, were kind-hearted and considerate, and would always do something to help the poor, bewildered, small boy who didn't know what to do next and who was always afraid of getting into trouble because so many adults hated to be asked things by small boys. I looked to the center of the temple, the center of the lamastic group, and I looked at our revered, beloved inmost one sitting there, serene and calm, with a very strong aura of spirituality, and I resolved that I would at all times try to model myself on him and on my guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondup. The service went on, and I'm afraid that I must have fallen asleep behind one of the pillars, because I knew nothing more until there was the loud ringing of the bells and the roaring of conches again, and then the sound as of a multitude rising to their feet and the indefinable noises which a lot of men make when they're making for an exit. So I rubbed my eyes with my knuckles and tried to look intelligent, tried to look awake as if I'd been paying attention. Wearily, I went along, again at the tail end, to our common dormitory, thinking how glad I was that after this night I should not be sleeping with the whole crowd of boys who rent the night with their snores and cries, but after this night I should be able to sleep alone. In the dormitory, as I prepared to wrap myself in my blanket, a boy was trying to talk to me, saying how wonderful he thought it was that I was going to have a place of my own. But he yawned heavily in the middle of his sentence and just fell to the ground sound asleep. I walked to the window, wrapped in my blanket, and looked out again at the starry night, at the spume of snow tearing away from the mountain tops and lit most beautifully by the rays of the rising moon. Then I, too, lay down and slept, and thought of nothing. My sleep was dreamless and peaceful. End of chapter 10.